You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. I'm Larry Stein. This weekend, on Saturday, May 16th, from 3 to 5 p.m., there's a public forum at the QUUF, the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. It's entitled Public Forum on Dementia and Alzheimer's Disease. This is a problem, of course, that is more and more prevalent as the population overall ages. And especially this community, which has a slightly older demographic than many others. The forum features three panelists and a moderator who all have very unique perspectives on the issues of dementia, Alzheimer's disease, and end-of-life issues, given the current laws and the current climate in the country. Appearing on the panel will be Rob Miller, the former executive director of Compassion and Choices of Washington. He'll be speaking about a new advanced directive for people with Alzheimer's disease that he and some attorneys and bioethicists have developed. It's quite an extensive document, very worth looking at and hearing about. Rob Miller himself is the recently retired executive director of Compassion and Choices of Washington. Stacy Lee Nelson of the San Juan Villa will be talking about ways of relating to people at different stages of Alzheimer's disease. And Phyllis Schachter, who lives in Bellingham, has a personal perspective based on the experience of her husband, Alan, and Phyllis, as he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and it progressed fairly quickly. I had a chance to talk to Phyllis Schachter before she made her way here for this Saturday event. She also has a TED Talk available on YouTube if you look up Phyllis Schachter, S-H-A-C-T-E-R, and the talk is called Not Here by Choice. It's quite a compelling talk about her experience with her husband facing end-of-life issues with Alzheimer's. Here's my conversation with Phyllis Schachter.
My husband died about a little more than 2 years ago when he decided to voluntarily stop eating and drinking so he didn't have to live into the late stages of Alzheimer's. I feel that my husband and I we knew that other people were going to follow in our footsteps, and we made our lives public every step of the way. And I'm taking this information and sharing it with other people as a means to help others, and it's been a very healing process for me to do that.
Tell us a little bit about yourself first before we get into the topic.
I moved here about 10 and a half years ago to the Pacific Northwest, which really feels like home to me, even though I was raised in California. I'm formally retired, but very actively involved in life, using all of my life skills. And most of my professional years were spent as a teacher and a business and technology consultant, which I did in partnership with my husband, Alan, who died about 2 years ago.
Well, you're clearly a good presenter. You're comfortable speaking on stage, even about very personal and very difficult topics.
Yeah. I am. I have spoken publicly before, because when we were consultants, we actually did a lot of continuing education for attorneys, and so I had to speak in front of audiences.
So the topic you're dealing with here in Port Townsend when you come here is your husband, you and your husband's experience with end of life in the world of Alzheimer's and dementia, and a particular angle on this, which has the acronym VSED.
Right. Voluntary stopping, mm-hmm, eating and drinking.
Mm-hmm. And this is,
and it's referred to usually as VSED or VSED.
I see. And this is something that is being talked about in the end-of-life world of our exploring the way we approach the end-of-life more and more now.
Absolutely. I think the main issue here is expanding the choices about how and when we die. And there are five states now that have the death with dignity law, and there are, I think, somewhere between about 15 and 20 more states that are working on it right now to get it passed. And I believe, all or most of the states in the relative near future will have that law. But a lot of people don't want to use that law and also want to have a way to peacefully pass. And there's an enormous amount of neurological disease in the world, in this country, and there aren't solutions for it. And, one of my deepest prayers is that there's a cure for Alzheimer's and other kinds of neurological disease. But the truth of the matter is, until that happens, Alzheimer's is the fastest growing disease today.
That's right.
And the most feared disease.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's why this meeting at the QUUF here is quite timely. Lots of people here are dealing with this and talking about this as the population ages.
There's the baby boomer generation, which I am the first year of. I just don't think that baby boomers are going to silently walk into dementia facilities.
That's interesting.
I think that this generation of people are going to want to think about, take more control over their life and be able to face real life issues more head on and think cogently about how they want to die and what kind of a death they want to have and be more conscious about it.
It's interesting the way you put it in terms of the generation. It's my generation, too. I'm in the same generation as you. And the way our generation has taken on a lot of accepted ways of the way things are done and looked at them and challenged them. And now we're talking about end-of-life issues and looking at them and challenging them and saying, is this the way we must do it?
That's right. I don't know if you've read Atul Gawande's book called Being Mortal. It's on the best.
Yeah.
Did you read it?
Not the whole thing, but I've read excerpts from it. I know it's a very, very, very popular, important new book.
I think it's an important book because it really admits that our medical profession largely has not been trained adequately to talk with people about end-of-life issues. And I certainly would like to have a peaceful, conscious end-of-life. I don't want to end up in a hospital. I don't want to end up in a dementia facility. I don't want to end up on a machine.
Let's just give our listeners here just a little short version of the very compelling TED Talk that I was able to watch. It's online, actually. Anybody can see it, right? Give us the direction how to get to your TED Talk.
Okay, so if you Google Phyllis Schachter, Phyllis, my last name is Schachter. So if you Google Phyllis Schachter, not here by choice, you'll get the YouTube of the TEDx talk. And in that talk, it's a 17.5-minute talk, and I go through the five choices that my husband made in the last about year and a half of his life that led up to his very conscious and deliberate decision, an educated decision, to decide to stop eating and drinking rather than live into the late stages of Alzheimer's disease.
That's right.
And he was diagnosed with both laryngeal cancer and Alzheimer's 6 weeks apart from each other at the end of 2011. And he actually healed naturally from the cancer in 4 months, but of course, which was a miracle unto itself. And I don't go into too much detail, but I tell a little bit about that in the TED Talk. But that was a very deliberate kind of healing also, and an alternative kind of healing. And then the Alzheimer's got worse, and there was nothing really that could be done about it. And there are 7 stages in Alzheimer's, and Alan was probably in about the 5th stage and still mentally competent when he made his decision to stop eating and drinking.
That's the really tricky part with Alzheimer's. I know a lot of people talk about death with dignity and the states that have that give residents the ability to make some of those decisions about end of life, but Alzheimer's complicates it so much in terms of the consciousness and the ability for the patient to be considered able to make decisions. Let's approach that complication of this whole thing.
That is the complication. And Alan and I, we had a very good marriage and very good communication between us, and we made an agreement that if I felt that he was going to lose his mental competency fairly soon, or would, just from my own gut level feeling, that I would share that information to him. And he had his own marker about what he would be able to do in his life or not be able to do. And when he knew when he got to those markers, he knew that it was going to be time for him. And but we really had that conversation where I felt he was just a couple months out. He was changing very, very quickly in those last, say, 10 months after he healed from cancer before he died. He was changing quite a bit, and I felt within a couple more months he would most likely not be mentally competent and wouldn't be able to follow through with what I knew what was so important to him. And I think when we're looking at the scope of an entire life, yes, maybe his life was shortened by a few months. Maybe that's true. But the truth of the matter about him is that he had such a good life. He was so grateful for the life that he had led. And he was absolutely clear about his decision. And it was also a decision that we had talked about for quite a few months separately with the doctor who actually helped him at the end of his life to make sure that he didn't suffer.
Did you have any interference or resistance from the kind of official medical establishment for the way you were conducting yourselves at this point, or were you pretty much on your own at that point?
That's a good question. And I would say a big part of my motivation in educating people about this is so that there is becomes the right support for people in the future, because that support is a little tenuous right now. But 40-45% of the hospitals and hospices in Washington State are owned by the Catholic Church, and although they didn't come out and say directly that we will not help your husband in hospice after he has started his fast, but that is what they said to me. They said, we won't help him until he's in the end stage of coma, and I felt he would suffer tremendously if that occurred. I'm a fairly resourceful person, and this was all done very deliberately over quite a long period of time before he actually started his fast in terms of my lining everything up. And so at the point when hospice said they wouldn't help, then I contacted our doctor just to tell her this, and she just, without my even asking, she just said, it was as if she was really responding to the highest calling of being a doctor, and she said, I will take care of Alan.
Well, unusual response compared to most of the medical establishment at this point. But
I think that's true. I think that there is an enormous amount of education that needs to be done also with the doctors. I'm just at the beginning of a process of working with three other colleagues who are either lawyers or bioethics professors or attorneys in bioethics who deal with end-of-life issues, and we've just started the conversation to plan the first national conference on VSED to be held at the end of 2016, hopefully in the Seattle area.
Oh, wow. The complexities of it are tremendous in terms of the issues of medical ethics and the protocol of hospitals and depending upon what organizations the hospitals are affiliated with. But it's in terms of Alzheimer's disease, the rights of people, say, in the state of Washington, where we do have a certain right to dictate the end of our life, the Alzheimer's situation puts it in a very vague area, I think, for most medical people.
I think that's true. What's also true, though, is that the United States Supreme Court in 1990 said that anyone has the right to refuse nutrition and hydration. And also the Supreme Court has asserted over and over again that, you know, anyone, they said in 1990 that anyone has a right to refuse, I think, medical treatment. And then they've asserted over and over again, anyone has the right to refuse nutrition and hydration. That has not been a law. That is something I actually asked my lawyer about, and what I hope I'm saying right now is actually true. And I said to her, well, how does something really become a law? Or how does it get, become a law at the level of, the Supreme Court? And a situation has to come up where it's contested and it's taken to court. Mm-hmm. And there's precedent and situations, right, ahead of time and so forth. But really, everything that my husband did was completely legal.
Sure.
So
sure.
We had, and toward the end, we even had our lawyer draw papers so that the doctor and myself and caregivers were not liable for anything, that this was his, voluntary choice.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that did happen is somebody in our community did make a call and call Adult Protective Services And on the second day, they don't give you notice when they come to your house. And on the second day, they came to our house unannounced. And I had the composure and was able to educate the social worker who came about what his choice was. She talked with Alan, and we had, all the legal papers to back it up, including a long paper that I had read that educated both Alan and me about legal ways to die. That was from the Widener Law Review, an article by Thaddeus Pope.
And so you were able to convince the social services person that this was all right, that she didn't have to intervene.
She was absolutely all right with it, there was no problem with it. Mm-hmm. I think, actually, she was amazed at the beauty, the serenity, and the knowledge of the house that she walked into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it. In your talk that I was able to watch, there's a striking moment in which you and your husband went to an Alzheimer's facility, and at that point he consciously made a decision, I will not end up staying in a place like this.
You know, I think that the vast majority of adults never go and visit Alzheimer's facilities, and after we did that, I recommend everybody do it, because it was such a pathetic, sad situation to see people in the last 18 months of their life in truly vegetative states on an average of 12 medications. They really were like the walking dead.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no life there. It wasn't humane. It wasn't human. And we just both, within a short time, we both cried.
Yeah.
We just said it was overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And nor could I even imagine me experiencing him and me having to watch him go through that.
Yeah.
In a facility.
Yeah. It's unfortunately more and more common place that people spend the last period of their life. And
it is, because there aren't alternatives.
Yeah.
And the reason why there aren't alternatives is because this kind of conversation isn't happening. Because this kind of conversation is going to lead to choice and alternatives.
Right, right.
Yeah.
One other resource that you referred me to before we're talking here on the phone is actually going to be highlighted by another person appearing at this conference at the QUUF named Rob Miller, who's from Compassion and Choices of Washington.
Yeah,
and I know I took a look at the document that they're working on called the Advanced Directives for People with Alzheimer's Disease. That's and they make it a point of saying this is not an end of life directive, but this is an advanced directive that is supposed to have some legal strength behind it for an Alzheimer's patient and family to document their wishes.
Right. So this is a completed form. It is on the Compassion and Choices of Washington website. My TED Talk is on their website also. And you can download not only their regular health directive, which is an excellent health directive, but you can download the Alzheimer's Advanced Mental Health Directive. I believe my husband was one of the first people to fill out this directive. I had been in conversation with Compassion and Choices, and it is one of their volunteer chaplains for Compassion and Choices that was the first person who suggested to me that I investigate voluntary stopping eating and drinking. Mm. And it's a very forthright and very good health directive for people who would be in the early stages of Alzheimer's, who can say things like, if I go to an Alzheimer's facility, this is where I would like to live. All the parameters of what you might want for yourself down the road, you can say, because in the relative near future, you're going to end up losing mental competence and you won't have a chance to say it.
And
even things such as, if I go into a facility, I give my spouse the freedom to have a relationship with somebody else. Or if I go into a facility, I could have a relationship with somebody else. I mean, it really gets you to think about all those horrible possibilities.
It's a very, very detailed and complete directive, and it has
impressive. So Rob Miller just retired after being an excellent executive director for Compassion and Choices of Washington. He's the executive director that was responsible for really helping to get this law passed. And he, in conjunction with a professor in Seattle, wrote this directive together. They worked on it for quite a while. It's a very, very good directive. I recommend that people look at it.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very well thought out. And the instructions on how to fill that out are longer than the directive itself, I think.
Yes, and so the interesting thing is he made me promise that I would go to an elder care attorney. But he actually was, he knew our case already. We were already in contact with Compassion and Choices. And the directive was completed, but all the instructions were not completed. And so he said, I will let you use the directive if you promise me you'll fill it out with an elder care attorney. Mm. And that's exactly what we did. So I think we were probably one of the first people who got to use that. And we did. We went to the lawyer's office and did a lot of it with her there. Because a lot of it also involved things having to do with our own personal finances and legal documents.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so happy that you're able to come out here and share this experience and knowledge with us here in Port Townsend. You'll be on quite a lineup of people featuring you and Rob Miller from Compassion and Choices Washington, the former director, and Stacy Lee Nelson of the San Juan Villa, which is a prominent local Alzheimer's facility. So,
right, and she'll be talking about caregiving, and so people are really going to get a full range of perspectives, which is good,
yeah,
very good.
Yeah. It's coming up from 3 to 5 on Saturday, May 16th, at the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I've been speaking with Phyllis Schachter from Bellingham, who you can see on her TEDx talk under Phyllis Schachter, S-H-A-C-T-E-R, not here by choice, but you can see Phyllis Schachter and talk to her May 16th at QUUF between 3 and 5 p.m. Thank you, Phyllis, for taking the time to talk ahead of this visit.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you, Larry, for asking me.
That was Phyllis Schachter speaking about her experience with her husband, Alan, with Alzheimer's and end-of-life issues. Phyllis is part of a panel, a public forum on dementia and Alzheimer's disease, Saturday, May 16th from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Appearing on the panel will be Phyllis, Rob Miller, the former executive director of Compassion and Choices of Washington, Stacy Lee Nelson of San Juan Villa, and the moderator is Sally McLaughlin, the community education director of Compassion and Choices of Washington. This Saturday, 3 to 5 p.m. at the QUUF. You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. I'm Larry Stein. Thanks for joining us.